Manager of the Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, Firas Al-Najm in Toronto.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات لأبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك سريع العقاب وإنه لغفور رحيم صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: Tehran says Washington's accusations that an Iranian citizen was plotting to assassinate a politician on U.S. soil are untrue and absurd. The town of Pisky in eastern Ukraine becomes the new flashpoint in the battle for control of Donetsk amid conflicting reports about the town falling to Russian troops. Plus, North Korea holds its southern neighbor responsible for the spread of COVID as it declares the outbreak is now successfully contained.
Our top story this hour: Iran has strongly rejected U.S.'s baseless accusations against an Iranian national who has been charged with planning terrorist operations in the United States. Foreign Ministry spokesman made the remark after the U.S. Justice Department charged an Iranian with plotting to murder John Bolton, a national security advisor to former President Donald Trump. Nasser Kanani said such unfounded accusations were brought up with purely political intentions to cover up numerous terrorist crimes committed by the U.S., Israel, and their affiliated terror groups. He also issued a stern warning about any measures taken against Iranian nationals on the basis of such, quote, ridiculous accusations. Kanani said Iran reserves the right to take necessary steps within the framework of international law to defend the rights of the country's government and nationals. Calls are growing again for the release of Afghanistan's assets. The United States has frozen since the Taliban takeover of the war-torn country. Several dozen prominent American and international economists have urged Washington to hand over to Afghanistan its assets. The signatories include Nobel laureates Joseph Stiglitz and Yanis Varoufakis. In a letter to President Joe Biden and Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, they expressed concern over economic and humanitarian catastrophes unfolding in Afghanistan and blamed them on the U.S. policy. They argued Washington could not justify holding onto the reserves and warned that Afghanistan would collapse if it did not get the money back. Washington is freezing more than $9 billion in assets belonging to the Afghan Central Bank
the UN and other international bodies had previously urged the US government to unfreeze the assets to allow Afghanistan deal with its crises. Iran's energy minister has visited Kabul and held bilateral talks with the Taliban officials. Both sides emphasized the importance of continued cooperation between the two neighboring countries. Rahmatullah Baghban reports from Kabul.
Iran's Minister of Energy, Ali Akbar Mehrabian, at the top of a delegation on Wednesday, paid a visit to Afghan capital Kabul and held meetings with Taliban's Ministers of Energy and Water, Foreign Affairs, Information and Cultures, and Deputy Prime Minister Mullah Baradar. The Iranian official's visit was aimed at pursuing Iran's rights to water supply from the Hermon River, as well as boosting cooperation between the two neighbors.
Today we discuss mutual issues with Afghan acting authorities, especially in the field of water and power. The Taliban officials agreed to release Iran's water allocations from the Hermon River based on the 1973 water treaty and in accordance with the rainfall rate in the area and the level of water in the river. Tomorrow our joint water commissioners will hold a meeting in Kabul to study the technical issues.
Iran and Afghanistan signed a water-sharing agreement on the Hermon River in 1973, under which Afghanistan pledged to release around 850 million cubic meters of water each year to Iran. So far, Iran has repeatedly criticized Afghanistan for failing to fulfill the accord. In the meantime, Afghanistan has been struggling with a looming electricity crisis, with vast bills remaining unpaid. Afghan acting officials urged Iran to continue supplying reliable electricity.
Iran has been supplying Afghanistan with 120 megawatt of electricity. We have failed to pay the bills, but we are committed to do so in the near future. As you know, since the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan came to power, the US and allies imposed cruel sanctions on our country and blocked our assets. As a result, we have been struggling to pay the debts to Iran, Uzbekistan, and Tajikistan. I hope Iran in particular won't stop supplying power to Afghanistan on grounds of delay in payments.
Iran and Afghanistan have the potential and opportunity to cooperate in many fields. Energy in particular can bring the two neighbors closer. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Turning to other news, Ukraine's eastern Donbass region remains the focus of ongoing Russia-Ukraine war, with the two sides now battling for the strategic town of Pisky. Heavy fighting is raging around the town amid conflicting claims. Pro-Russian groups in Donetsk say Pisky is now under control of Russian troops and separatist forces. They say, however, that there are some pockets of resistance in the town. Ukrainian officials have denied the claim, saying their forces are continuing to fight back. The Donbass region comprised of Luhansk and Donetsk provinces. Luhansk is now almost completely under Russian control, but Donetsk is still holding out. The region has been a scene of bloody conflict between the Ukrainian army and pro-Russian groups since 2014. Capturing Donbass was the main objective of Moscow since it launched a military offensive in Ukraine in February. The war in Ukraine is a human tragedy that has resulted in the death of many innocent people. It also displays how there has not been enough push for diplomacy, particularly from the United States. While Russia has been described by the West as an aggressor, Ukraine too has been found guilty of killing civilians. And this is while the US has flooded Ukraine with lethal weapons, much of which do not even reach Ukrainian forces and goes unaccounted for.
The war in Ukraine has caused enormous distress to the civilian population in the war-stricken areas. Ukraine and Russia have accused each other of endangering the lives of civilians. A report by Amnesty International, which is a Western rights group and is biased towards Western-style liberal democracies, has now accused Ukraine of flouting international law by exposing civilians to Russian fire. The report accuses the Ukrainian military of having established its bases in schools and hospitals. It says the Ukrainian military has launched counterattacks from heavily populated areas.
So the West is actively shaping the narrative, and it's also realizing that the narrative that the West has been provoking through Ukraine, that Ukraine has been regurgitating, is becoming increasingly seen as absolutely false. There's no facts or truth behind any of the words or the ideas or the images that the U.S. narrative has been trying to communicate. Specifically, the Russians are not losing, the Russians are not retreating.
As it was expected, the report angered Ukrainian officials. In reaction to Kiev's objection, Amnesty has issued a statement expressing its regret for the, quote, distress and anger that the report has caused amongst Ukrainian officials. Amnesty has, however, said that it stands by its findings. It has noted that the evidence it has documented does not justify, quote, Russia's violations. The blame game comes amid intensified efforts by the United States to keep the war going in East Ukraine.
Well, I think the grotesque blundering and failure of the United States in Ukraine has been ongoing for a long, long time, of course, ever since 2009 to 2019. The United States has been involved with funding illegal global viral biological chemical labs. It's been involved with training Ukrainian soldiers, inspiring them to commit acts of genocide. The U.S. has been behind all of the Ukrainian madness for a long time.
The U.S. has been the largest contributor of weapons to Ukraine by far. Ironically, other NATO members who have supplied Ukraine with weapons, like Germany, had actually purchased their weapons from American arms manufacturers. And then comes the question, where do those unaccounted weapons end up? According to Interpol, many will end up on the black market and in the hands of criminals.
The Biden administration has just announced a $1 billion arms and weapons package for Ukraine. That's the largest military installment to Ukraine since the war began in February. The upcoming military package is the 18th such tranche and brings U.S. commitment to about $9.8 billion. The package consists of HIMARS systems, 75,000 rounds of 155mm artillery ammunition, mortar systems, and 20,000 rounds and mortar ammunition, as well as munitions for National Advanced Surface-to-Air Missile Systems.
Most of these weapon systems are actively being manned and fired, and targeting is being done by U.S. Military and CIA forces, as well as British. But the Ukrainians are doing very, very little, except they're dying. So all of the weapons that the West has sent in there, I think, was initially done recklessly without any real consideration of what the military requirements are for training.
The HIMARS are designed to shoot a variety of missiles and have sat high on Ukrainian wish lists. The supply of arms and weapons to Ukraine comes amid reports that the weapons sent to Ukraine do not make it to the front lines. There are reports that only 30% of weapons sent to Ukraine actually end up in the hands of Ukrainians. Reports say the rest go missing.
And now, I think the irony is all of these weapons are simply being sold on the black market by various parties because they're unmanageable. Now, what you will see most likely as well are these weapon systems emerging in small conflicts in Europe, which could be all sorts of domestic insurrections. You could have criminal gangs using a lot of these weapons. So the real loser of all of these Western weapons from the United States that have been sent in is going to be Europe.
Just recently, U.S. news channel CBS was forced to partially retract a documentary in which it said that shipments of weapons to Ukraine from the U.S. had been going missing. The documentary had apparently angered officials in Ukraine. It now appears that warlords in Washington are committing the same mistake they did in Afghanistan and Syria.
I like the structural path we're on here. As long as we help Ukraine with the weapons they need and the economic support, they will fight to the last person.
The Washington regime has poured so much weapons and ammunition in those regions that wars will likely continue for years. Now Ukraine appears to be the next victim of Washington's warmongering machinery.
Elsewhere, tensions between North and South Korea flare up again, this time over the COVID pandemic. The sister of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un warns of retaliation over what she called Seoul's attempt to send the coronavirus to her country. Yo Jong blamed the outbreak on balloons flown by South Korean activists near the border, saying they contain leaflets contaminated with the virus. She said Pyongyang would respond strongly in case balloons continued to fly. She said it is worrisome Seoul is sending leaflets, money, sloppy brochures and other items across the border. South Korea has rejected the accusation, calling Pyongyang's claims groundless. Yo Jong's warning followed the announcement by the North Korean leader that his country has successfully curbed the outbreak. This is while North Korean officials have never confirmed how many people contracted the virus. Frank Smith is our correspondent in the South Korean capital, Seoul, and joins us now. Frank, so South Korea has rejected this accusation by the North, but nevertheless, tensions are rising again on the Korean Peninsula.
Yes, they are. Part of the reason is that South Korea and the U.S. are scheduled to begin kind of unprecedented military exercises, at least over the last 4 or 5 years under previous President Moon Jae-in. These joint U.S.-South Korea drills were suspended in the interest of generating engagement and negotiations with North Korea. Moon the former president of South Korea, succeeded in bringing together South Korea and North Korea for some negotiations, calm down the kind of tension that had existed on the peninsula. President Moon also arranged summits between North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and former U.S. President Donald Trump. Unfortunately, the moratorium, the self-imposed moratorium that the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un placed on his nuclear weapons program and missile testing really didn't succeed in getting any concessions out of the U.S., and now the U.S. is kind of playing the card of strategic patience that we saw under Obama, where it's saying that they will negotiate with North Korea unconditionally, whereas North Korea, again, it had already placed this moratorium, wanted to improve relations, and really got nothing out of the U.S. So North Korea remains under U.S.-led United Nations Security Council and also U.S. Sanctions against its country, and wants to see those lifted before it enters into any talks with the U.S. On the nuclear weapons and on the missile testing issues.
Right. Okay, Frank, thank you very much indeed for that. Frank Smith there, our correspondent, joining us from the South Korean capital, Seoul. In other news, during its recent aggression on the besieged Gaza Strip, the Israeli regime killed dozens of civilians, including children, across the territory. The regime attacked several homes and workplaces, showing complete disregard towards the lives of Palestinians. That brings an end to World Bulletin.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee, so recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday 5 things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Through its agencies, the U.S. government regularly plants fake news and false information. Therefore, social media hiring individuals straight from the FBI, CIA, NATO, and other groups to work on regulating disinformation is a fundamentally flawed practice. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Alan McLeod, journalist. This article is published under the heading, The Federal Bureau of Tweets. Twitter is hiring an alarming number of FBI agents. Twitter has been on a recruitment drive of late, hiring a host of former feds and spies. Studying a number of employment and recruitment websites, Mint Press has ascertained that the social media giant has, in recent years, recruited dozens of individuals from the national security state to work in the fields of security, trust, safety, and content. Chief amongst these is the Federal Bureau of Investigations. The FBI is generally known as a domestic security and intelligence force. However, it has recently expanded its remit into cyberspace. The FBI's investigative authority is the broadcast of all federal law enforcement agencies. The About section of its website informs the readers. It adds, the FBI has divided its investigations into a number of programs, such as domestic and international terrorism, foreign counterintelligence, and cybercrime. For example, in 2019, Don Burton, the former director of Washington operations for Lockheed Martin, was poached from her job as senior innovation advisor to the director at the FBI to become senior director of strategy and operations for legal, public policy, trust, and safety at Twitter. The following year, Karen Walsh went straight from 21 years at the Bureau to become Director of Corporate Resilience at the Silicon Valley giant. Twitter's Deputy General Counsel and Vice President of Legal, Jim Packer, also spent 4 years at the FBI between 2014 and 2018, where his resume notes he rose to the role of senior strategic advisor. Meanwhile, Mark Jaroszewski ended his 21-year posting as a supervisory special agent in the Bay Area to take up a position at Twitter, rising to become Director of Corporate Security and Risk. And Douglas Turner spent 14 years as a senior special agent and SWAT team leader before being recruited to serve in Twitter's corporate and executive security services. Previously, Turner had also spent 7 years as a Secret Service special agent with the Department of Homeland Security. When asked to comment by Mint Press, former FBI agent and whistleblower Colleen Rowley said she was not surprised at all to see FBI agents now working for the very tech companies. The agency policies stating that there now exists a revolving door between the FBI and the areas they are trying to regulate. This created a serious conflict of interest in her mind, as many agents have one eye on post-retirement jobs. She said, the truth is that at the FBI, 50% of all normal conversations that people had were about how you were going to make your money after retirement. Many former FBI officials hold influential roles within Twitter. For instance, in 2020, Matthew W. left a 15-year career as an intelligence program manager at the FBI to take up the post of Senior Director of Product Trust at Twitter. Patrick G., a 23-year FBI supervisory special agent, is now head of corporate security. And Twitter's director of insider risk and security investigations, Bruce A., was headhunted from his role as a supervisory special agent at the Bureau. His resume notes that at the FBI, he held various intelligence and law enforcement roles in the US, Africa, Europe, and Middle East, and was a human intelligence and counterintelligence regional specialist. On employment sites such as LinkedIn, many users choose not to reveal their full names. Meanwhile, between 2007 and 2021, Jeff Carlton built up a distinguished career in the United States Marine Corps, rising to become a senior intelligence analyst. Between 2014 and 2017, his LinkedIn profile notes he worked for both the CIA and FBI, authored dozens of official reports, some of which were read by President Barack Obama. Carlton describes his role as a problem solver and claims to have worked in many dynamic, high-pressure environments such as Iraq and Korea. In May 2021, he left official service to become a senior program manager at Twitter, responsible for dealing with the company's highest-profile trust and safety escalations. Other former FBI staff are employed by Twitter, such as Cheryl Vai as a policy domain specialist and Laura D as a senior analyst in global risk intelligence. Many of those listed were active in the FBI's public outreach programs, a practice sold as a community trust-building initiative. According to Rowley, however, these also function as ways for officials to meet the important people that would give them jobs after retirement. It basically inserts a huge conflict of interest, she told me in press, adding, "It warps and perverts the criminal investigative work that agents do when they're still working as agents because they anticipate getting lucrative jobs after retiring or leaving the FBI." Twitter certainly has endorsed the FBI as a credible actor, allowing the organization to play a part in regulating the global dissemination of information on its platform. In September 2020, it put out a statement thanking the federal agency. "We wish to express our gratitude to the FBI's Foreign Influence Task Force for their close collaboration and continued support of our work to protect the public conversation on this critical time," the statement read. 1 month later, the company announced that the FBI was feeding its intelligence and that it was complying with the request for deletion of accounts. In 2019, Twitter also hired Greg Anderson, straight from NATO, to work on cybercrime policy. This is a sparse information of what Anderson did at NATO, but alarmingly, his own LinkedIn profile stated simply that he worked on psychological operations for the military alliance. After Mint Press highlighted this fact in an article in April, he removed all mention of psychological operations from his profile, claiming now to have merely worked as a NATO researcher. Anderson left Twitter in the summer of last year to work as a product policy manager for the popular video platform TikTok. Twitter also directly employs active army officers. In 2019, Gordon McMillan, the head of the editorial for the entire Europe, West Asia region and Africa region, was revealed to be an officer in the British Army's notorious 77th Brigade, a unit dedicated to online warfare and psychological operations. This bombshell news was steadfastly ignored across the media. With nearly 400 million global users, there is no doubt that Twitter has grown to become a platform large and influential enough to necessitate extensive security measures as actors of all stripes attempt to use the service to influence public opinion and political actions. There is also no doubt that there is a limited pool of people qualified in these sorts of fields. But recruiting largely from the U.S. national security state fundamentally undermines claims Twitter makes about its neutrality. The U.S. government is the source of some of the largest and most extensive influence operations in the world. As far back as 2011, The Guardian reported on the existence of a massive worldwide U.S. military online influence campaign in which it had designed software that allowed its personnel to secretly manipulate social media sites by using fake online persons to influence internet conversations and spread pro-American propaganda. The program boasts that the background of these personas is so convincing that psychological operation soldiers can be sure to work without fear of being discovered by sophisticated adversaries. Yet Twitter appears to be recruiting from the source of the problem. These former national security state officials are not being employed in politically neutral departments such as sales or customer service, but in security, trust, and content, meaning that some hold considerable sway over what messages and information are promoted and what is suppressed, demoted, or deleted. Some might ask, what is the problem with Twitter actively recruiting from the FBI, CIA, and other three-letter agencies? They, after all, are experts in studying online disinformation and propaganda. What is optical? If a Russian-owned social media app's trust, security, and content moderation was run by former KGB or FSB agents and still insisted it was a politically neutral platform, the entire world would laugh. But apart from this, the huge influx of security state personnel into Twitter's decision-making ranks means that the company will start to view every problem in the same manner as the U.S. government does and act accordingly. In terms of their outlooks on the world and on the question of misinformation and internet security, you couldn't get a better field of professionals who are almost inherently going to be more in tune with the government's perspective. Thus, when policing the platform for disinformation and influence campaigns, the former FBI and CIA agents and Atlantic Council fellows only ever seem to find them emanating from enemy states and never from the U.S. regime itself. Twitter has mirrored U.S. hostility towards states like Russia, China, and Cuba, attempting to suppress the reach and influence of their state media by adding warning messages to the tweets of journalists and accounts affiliated with those governments. In a rather bizarre adamant, it explained that it would not be doing the same to state-affiliated media or personalities from other countries, least of all the U.S. state-financed media organizations with editorial independence, like NPR, for example, are not defined as a state-affiliated media for the purposes of this policy, it wrote. Perhaps most notable, however, was Twitter's announcement last year that it was deleting dozens of accounts for the new violation of undermining faith in the NATO alliance. The statement was widely ridiculed online by users. But few noted that the decision was based upon a partnership with the Stanford Internet Observatory, a counter-disinformation think tank, filled with former spooks and state officials, and headed by an individual who is on the advisory board of NATO's Collective Cybersecurity Center of Excellence. That Twitter is working so closely with organizations that are clearly intelligence industry cat's paws should concern all users. While some might be alarmed that Twitter is cultivating such an intimate relationship with the FBI and other groups belonging to the secret state, it is perhaps unfair to single it out, as many social media platforms are doing the same. Facebook, for example, has entered into formal partnership with the Atlantic Council's Digital Forensics Research Lab, whereby the latter holds significant influence over 2.9 billion users' news feeds, helping to decide what content to promote and what content to suppress. The NATO cutout organization now serves as Facebook eyes and ears, according to a Facebook press release. Anti-war and anti-establishment voices across the world have reported massive drops in traffic on the platform. The social media giant also hired former NATO press secretary Ben Nemo to be its head of intelligence. Nemo subsequently used his power to attempt to swing the election in Nicaragua away from the leftist Sandinista party and towards the far-right pro-US candidate, deleting hundreds of left-wing voices in the week of the election, claiming they were engaging in inauthentic behavior. When these individuals, including some well-known personalities, poured onto Twitter, recording video messages proving they were not bots, Twitter deleted those accounts too, in what one commentator called a Silicon Valley double-tap strike. An April Mint Press study revealed how TikTok, too, has been filling its organization with alumni of the Atlantic Council, NATO, the CIA, and the State Department. As with Twitter, these new TikTok employees largely work in highly politically sensitive fields such as trust, safety, security, and content moderation, meaning these state operatives hold influence over the direction of the company and what content is promoted and what is demoted. In corporate media, too, we have seen a widespread infiltration of former security officials into the upper echelons of news organizations. So normalized is the penetration of the national security state into the media that is supposed to be holding it into account that few reacted in 2015 when Dawn Eskenazi left her job as National Intelligence Manager for the Western Hemisphere as the Director of National Intelligence to become the Global Business Director of international news conglomerate Thomson Reuters. Eskenazi, a 33-year CIA veteran who had worked her way up to become a director in the organization, was open about what her role was. In a blog post on the Reuters website, she wrote that she was there to meet the desperate needs of the U.S. government, a statement that is at odds with even the most basic journalistic concepts of impartiality and holding the powerful to account. Meanwhile, cable news outlets routinely employ a wide range of former agents and mandarins as trusted personalities and experts. These include former CIA directors John Brennan and Michael Hayden, ex-director of National Intelligence James Clapper, and former Homeland Security Advisor Francis Townsend. And news for so many Americans comes delivered through ex-CIA interns like Anderson Cooper, CIA applicants like Tucker Carlson, or by Mika Brzezinski, the daughter of a powerful National Security Advisor. The FBI has its own former agents on TV as well, with talking heads such as James Gagliano, Asha Rakpa, and Frank Figolowski becoming household names. In short, then, the national security state once used to infiltrate the media. Today, however, the national security state is the media. Social media holds enormous influence in today's society. While this article is not alleging that anyone mentioned is a bad actor or does not genuinely care about the spread of disinformation, it is highlighting a glaring conflict of interest. Through its relief agencies, the U.S. government regularly plants fake news and false information. Therefore, social media hiring individuals straight from the FBI, CIA, NATO, and other groups to work on regulating disinformation is a fundamentally flawed practice. One of media's primary functions is to serve as a fourth estate, a force that works to hold the government and its agencies to account. Yet instead of doing that, increasingly it is collaborating with them. Such are these increasing interlocking connections that it is becoming increasingly difficult to see where big government ends and big media begins.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Ashura in Britain.
Part 2.
In the year 680 AD, in the middle of the dry desert of Karbala, a man and around 70 of his followers were surrounded by an army of several thousands.
They all knew, even the women and children in that camp knew, that the enemy was not only ready to fight, they were ready to kill.
He knew that he was going to get killed. On the night of Ashura, he told his companions that tomorrow all of us are going to be killed. So anyone who wants to leave, let him leave.
Over 1,300 years have passed since this event, but Imam Hussein's brutal death is still commemorated every year. The day is known as Ashura, and remembering its message has spread across the world, including Britain. Why?
If we just let that message to be lost in the books of history, have we not betrayed Hussein? Have we not betrayed the grandson of the Prophet?
Karbala may have marked the end of Hussein's life as his heart stopped beating in the dry desert, but it was the birth of a powerful message. The message of a man who sought to rectify what had gone wrong. It is a story that has captivated the world.
For most people, it's very emotional. You can't really say add to it, except we should try and emulate Imam Hussein.
What we see in Karbala is a manifestation of the human spirit in its most fitri state, a yearning for justice. And so the events of Karbala, they don't only pull on our hearts, but they pull on our minds, they pull on our emotions.
The Quran criticizes Jews for killing their prophets, which history records that they killed many of their prophets, criticizes the Jews for killing their prophets. And I think one of the criticisms to Muslim Ummah is that they killed someone like Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet, peace be on him.
I have a lot of sadness to think that he was the Prophet's grandson and that he was murdered by the caliph of his time, and that it was an act of political violence. Was a senseless death in its way.
It's the most moving event, and it's an inspiration.
After Hussein was killed, people almost immediately began to sense his message. The first impact was felt in Kufa by those who had betrayed him or had turned back on their pledge in helping him. A large group of around 5,000 people who called themselves the Tawabun, the Repentant, realizing the enormity of what had happened, decided to take arms to fight against the Umayyads. The second impact was even larger and took place in Damascus, in the very palace of Yazid. Hussein's sister Zainab, who was captured along with the other women of Hussein's camp, began to publicize the news of Hussein's death. She also defended his cause so powerfully that those companions of the Prophet who were still alive, and even Yazid's household, were appalled by what had happened.
Well, the agony in Imam Hussein's story is that he was killed by a Muslim. He is the martyr who wasn't killed by a non-Muslim.
The impact that this event, this tragic event, had on Muslim community is tremendous. The shame of killing a person like Hussein ibn Ali for not paying allegiance to a person like Yazid, not putting up any fight or anything like that, just for not paying allegiance.
The impact of Hussein's message didn't just affect the Umayyads, but also anyone in the future who would try to distort the Prophet's legacy of justice. It quickly became a tradition to relate accounts of the brutal treatment of the Prophet's grandson and to defend his cause. People who heard these accounts would sit and mourn.
People find when they come to listen to lectures, when they come to remember Imam Hussein alayhi salam, when they come to remember what he went through, what he said, they find upliftment, they find spiritual gaining, they find motivation and inspiration for them to be good Muslims, to be role model Muslims in society, and to preach Islam and to understand Islam better.
In the vast expanse of the Muslim world, people would remember Hussein with grief and compassion. Seeing this, the Umayyads attempted to mark the day of Ashura as a day of celebration for their victory over Hussein. But then, something happened that was to shake the Umayyads to their very core. A trend was developing. Now, even those who had inherited the custom of celebrating Yazid's victory were beginning to commemorate Hussein's defiance. This has now reached Britain.
Everyone's come here to celebrate and commemorate the death of Imam Hussein and to remember him, and this is our call to the world that we'll never forget Imam Hussein. And he stood against terrorism that day, and we're today standing against terrorism with all this walking and all this marching.
We are inspired by the example of people like Imam Hussein and the martyrs. We are inspired not to give in to evil. We're inspired to resist. We're inspired to oppose and fight and combat evil. And so to me, that is very meaningful, very important, very significant.
I think it's something strange, which I don't think is ever going to happen again, as you would not expect 72 people to go in war with over, like, 20,000 people. And it's just the way that they hold on as much as they could without any water or anything, and they just saved our religion.
The way him and his family were butchered, like, you could use the word butchered, really. The way they were butchered in Karbala is just so heart-wrenching.
As the commemoration spread, Hussein's name became etched in history. He became the symbol of justice. And visiting his place of martyrdom became a ritual. During the Abbasids, the second Muslim dynasty, visiting Hussein's place of martyrdom became so popular that in 850 AD, the Caliph Mutawakkil ordered his forces to destroy Hussein's tomb, to punish anyone who visited it, and to wipe Hussein's name from the pages of history.
If we do not pass on this message by the commemoration of this event, I think we have betrayed Hussein, as the people of Kufa betrayed Hussein. And certainly we do not want to betray the grandson of the Prophet. and we have the duty of passing on that message.
There's nothing in Islam or in the Sunnah of the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, his family, that prohibits remembering him and his family. You have gatherings, people remembering the great exploits of certain companions as well. So people will gather together to hear about to learn and hear about the lives of the companions. So I can't quite see what is the problem for gathering together to learn and hear about the heroic actions of his own family.
Attempts to wipe Hussein's name from history was proving difficult. It seemed to only add to people's sympathy for him. Then, in 963 AD, everything changed. In Baghdad, people rose up and poured into the streets, beating themselves and wailing for Hussein.
Because of the passion and feeling of the community, Muslim community, this was kept alive. And now it has spread everywhere.
Soon, artificial fountains were set up in cities, towns and villages to remember the thirst of Hussein and his family. People would drink from these fountains and would remember Hussein with tears in their eyes. In the 14th century AD, during the Mongolian Timurid dynasty, the commemoration of Ashura had spread to the vast Sunni population of Khorasan. Also, a man called Mullah Hussein Kashifi, arguably one of the most popular Sunni scholars of his time, became famous for his book, Razatul Shuhada. This book depicted the graphic events of Karbala, albeit with exaggeration.
Commemoration ceremony in Iran is called traditionally Roza Khani, that is reciting Roza, referring to the book of Mullah Hussein Kashifi, Roza to Shuhada. And nowadays, of course, people here, we go to Roza Khani session, that's reciting Roza. They don't know what does it mean.
People had now developed an unstoppable passion for Hussein. Exaggerations gradually crept into all aspects of the story, the ceremony, and the mourning.
We shouldn't just make this as a passion play. We have to convey the message of Hussein, peace be on him. We have to discuss what he meant.
Today, when people do gather together, it's not just going over the past again. It's bringing the whole spirit of the event into our lives.
Various cultures and local customs began to influence new traditions of mourning. From people hitting their heads with swords, wounding their shoulders, and walking on hot coal. Islamic scholars condemned these practices as unnecessary. But it just didn't stop. Today, the centuries-old tradition of commemorating Ashura has spread across the world, particularly in Indonesia, Egypt, Turkey, Iran, Kuwait, and Bahrain, as well as throughout America and Europe, including Britain. It seems that Ashura's message was global.
I think the message has a universality, because the experience of suffering and martyrdom are common to all sorts of great religions, maybe all of them.
We are talking about a version of Islam that touches the hearts of the people. And what attracted them in the subcontinent towards Islam was not a sword. That marching procession would inform the people of the entire story of Karbala and how it happened back in those days.
We have had many examples of non-Muslims, and especially the Hindus, who believe that Hussein is not for the Muslims only. Hussein is for us. Hussein Sabka. He says, Hussein Mera, Hussein is mine. Hussein Tera, Hussein is yours. Hussein Rabka, Hussein is of Allah. Hussein Sabka, Hussein is for everyone.
The Imam, on the way to his martyrdom at Karbala, invoked
the figure of Yahya ibn Zakaria, in Christianity we call him John the Baptist, who suffered martyrdom at the hand of a wicked man because of his righteousness.
The comparisons between the suffering of Imam Hussein and Jesus Christ were inevitable. In countries around the world, this has led to opportunities for Muslims and Christians to unite in the remembrance of these commanding figures. More recently in Britain, organisers of Islamic ceremonies have invited Christians to their programmes to commemorate Imam Hussein.
There were about 9 priests in that programme. And when I recite first suffering of Jesus and after that suffering of Imam Hussein, the night was Shab-e Ashur, the 10th night, Muharram. So many Christians, they were weeping. Even some priests, they were weeping. In the church, we finished program at 1:30 night. That priest came and said, "It's wonderful, never happened in church."
To share that, what suffering means to me in my head intellectually, but also in my heart, what it means to me as a Christian and as a human being. And then to hear someone like Maulana Kazmi speak about the suffering of Imam Hussein and the suffering of Jesus as well, I just think it's really very, very important.
As we engage with Jesus' sufferings, then that is something which provides similarity with the Ashura commemorations.
The real life is a spiritual life. Look, the suffering of Imam Hussein and suffering of Jesus. We heard suffering of Jesus. How the 72 people in Karbala, in Iraq,
that sort of demonstrative showing of solidarity, yes, with the historical figure, with Imam Hussein, but also one with each other, can be a very powerful experience.
The emotion is terribly important, and for whatever reason, sometimes we don't let it come out, maybe because we're being too British and we're keeping a stiff upper lip.
Religion is not a matter of a private sphere. It's not something which you do for an hour on Sunday morning. It's something that affects your whole life. And so I'm all in favour of these great events being commemorated in a public setting.
In the last 40 years in Britain, the remembrance of Imam Hussein has grown. From charities, street processions to conferences, keeping Imam Hussein's name alive seems to be an important activity.
Imam Hussein